Thanks, John.
Well, I'll tell you, I am Bonnie Patterson, and I'm an alcoholic. I don't think any of you here tonight can really know how thankful I am that I'm sober. And I am a nervous wreck. It's not because I'm up here before my dear sweet friends, but it's because of this terrible weather, and I can't help it. So John asked me to introduce our wonderful speaker tonight. And for the benefit of those who don't know this, he told me today I could tell you that he is the oldest living sober AA member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He has 33 years. I'm just going to have to tell you how I met Clarence. I was in Mobile at a meeting. It was a night about like this, and I had asked a girl to drive from Gulfport, Mississippi, to come up and speak for me. And when I have a meeting, if I see a strange face, I always ask them if they'd like to say something. And that night, I really needed somebody to say a few words until Sarah got there. So I spotted this man. I did not know who he was. And I asked him if he would fill in for me until my speaker arrived. So Clarence got up, and when my speaker arrived, he thanked me and had a seat. And I knew then I'd made a mess of a lot of things. But after that, we went to visit him in his motel, and I saw him later down in New Orleans where he spoke at a very big church. So when I left, he says, Bonnie, any time I can fill in for you, says, just let me know. So tonight, I want to assure Clarence that I didn't call him just to fill in, but I'm going to give him the entire evening if he wants it. And I am real delighted that he could come and be with us, because to me, he has a beautiful message. It's all yours, Clarence.
Well, thank you, Bonnie. You know, I am always interested in listening and find out what people are going to say on introductions. It's one of these things that not only for myself, but for other people. And I recall one person one time introduced me at one of these conventions. I was a banquet speaker there, and he went through a long harangue and building me up with a lot of things I didn't deserve, I imagine. But so finally he said, and I want to further tell you that I want you to meet the oldest man in the world. Well, so it goes. First of all, I do want to thank Bonnie, and I want to thank the committee for asking me here to take part in your 10th anniversary, and I also want to congratulate your group. Anniversaries are great things. I am a great believer in them. Some people don't agree with that. But I do think that anniversaries are a time when we can take a glance back over our shoulder and see where we came from. It's a good time to appraise what we have today. And that should give us a lot of hope for the future. I think these are three things that that anniversaries can do for us. In our pell-mell way of living, sometimes we just forget to take stock, you know. Our program teaches us that we should, but we forget this sometimes. An anniversary is a good time to do it, and I'm a great believer, and I just had my 33rd anniversary on February 11th, and I always observe it in Winter Haven, Florida. If I don't go anyplace else, I always wind up there. They were the first group who ever invited me to share my anniversary with them in Florida. So I go there every year. And it's an occasion I look forward to. I really do. And I always think about some of the things and what brought me here, how I happened to wind up here in the first place, and what's happened to me, and what I may expect for the future. I come in here tonight, and it's a marvelous thing to me. I meet old friends here tonight. I've met in Tennessee, California, Georgia, and in Florida, and in Carolinas, and in Virginia. All people here tonight that I've met in these various places. And this thing of AA has such a universality to it. And it's a remarkable thing to me that this can be done. When I look back to the days when I first came to this fellowship, and we struggled along, there was probably 40 men who had ever been exposed to this when I came here. And then when we started our group in Cleveland, Ohio, I remember we started out with about a dozen, and I just hoped that someday we'd have as many as 30 members and we'd have a real good group. Just think what's happened over the years. And I've often said that I could be the foremost dressed-up bum in the world, because I know so many people around the country and out of the country in AA that I could feel... I'm quite certain I could go and visit you for a couple of days, I could visit you for a couple of days, and you, the time I made the rounds again, why, I'd be company again. And you would treat me nice, you'd put me up and feed me and all this sort of thing, and this would be great. I've been considering this as an adjunct to my Social Security. But I'll tell you one thing, we all have this security here. This is the greatest thing that could ever happen in this century, this thing of AA, and I really believe it. And when it takes one washed out rummy or two washed out rummies to take another one and show him the way and help him up to where he can really live as human being is supposed to live, there's never been anything in history to rival this or to compare with it. And I really believe that this gift that we have is the greatest thing that's ever happened in the 20th century. I do. Well, we're here to talk about alcoholics and alcoholism. I'm going to kick this thing out of here. I'll soon have it on the floor if I don't. This is a game they play in some AA groups with these tin ashtrays and the concrete floors. It's just when things get going good, they start dropping them all over the place. Why, you know, contrary to what a lot of people think, an alcoholic isn't what they usually think. An alcoholic, to me, is a different breed of cats than other people. I think he's entirely different, and he always will be different. And the biggest mistake an alcoholic can ever do is for him to get the idea in his little noggin that he is normal people. When he starts to do that, he starts to think. And when an alcoholic starts to think, he gets in trouble. And this is the biggest difference I see between alcoholics and earth people. They think, and the alcoholic emotes. The alcoholic only reacts to the way he feels. He never reacts to reason or common sense. You don't believe it, sit down and go over your past life in your alcoholic career and consider what happened to you. And you can answer the question yourself whether this is reasonable behavior. Take a periodic drinker, for instance. Everything becomes a shambles. So he finally gets himself pulled together and he gets a new job. He gets a new wife. He gets a new home, he gets a new car, he gets a new job, he gets a new bank account, he has some jingle in his pocket, and he's going places, he gets some advancements, and he's going great. And all of a sudden, boom, there he goes again. Now, this is reasonable behavior of a thinking person? The guy's nuts. And second of all, if you're not nuts, you don't belong here. And if you are, you're welcome. Now, the alcoholic is a different breed of cats, and he can be characterized, and you can put him in a pigeonhole by characteristics. And every person who drinks excessively is not an alcoholic. I met a lot of heavy drinkers and a lot of drunks who didn't have sense enough to be an alcoholic. If alcoholic has to have something on the ball, he has to have an imagination. He has to be a sensitive soul. He's always one of these fellows that run around looking for someone to hurt his feelings. He's an extremist, and he never does anything by halfway measures. As I often said, when he works hard, and he plays hard, and when he gets drunk, he makes a career out of it. The alcoholic is, he's a... he's not only sensitive, but he has great deep feelings. He's a kid, and his emotions are moved very easily. And this doesn't end, this doesn't come to an end or modify much by being sober. He always has this potential. The alcoholic, well, we've seen it so many times. You take to the alcoholic when you're trying to work on one of them. The only time we can ever score with an alcoholic and put this idea across to him is when he feels badly. If he feels good, if he's drunk, you can't do anything with him. But when he's coming off of that drunk and he's shaking and he's sick and he's sweating and he's everybody's after him, he's in trouble, then we can talk to him and he'll respond. Because when he's drunk, he don't feel anything. He's all right. He's a happy guy. He don't hurt. But when he hurts, that's when he comes here. And unless he hurts real badly, he's not going to take this program of ours. It's too ridiculous for him. But he has to hurt. Now, did this thing go off? No, it's still on. You might be listening to this for 2 or 3 hours. I don't want it to cut off. What is alcoholism? I think that, and I've noticed this over the years, a lot of things have been tried with alcoholics, different types of rehabilitation plans and lots of advice. We've all had $1 million worth of good advice. I know I did when I was drinking. Never did me any good. But I had the advice. Didn't cost me anything. But I had it. These rehabilitation plans, most of them, the reason they fail is because they assume that the alcoholic is a logical, thinking human being and that he can respond to logic and reason. So they give him a lot of logical reasons and so forth why he should modify his drinking or why he should quit, and they give him a program to follow accordingly. Well, the big mistake right off the bat is they're starting on a false premise. This guy never responds to reason and common sense. So he's doomed to failure before they start. But when he comes to this fellowship of ours, these questions aren't asked of him. He's accepted for what he is, and we share our experience with him. We share our strength and our hope with him. I think the power of example in AA can never be overplayed. When we come, I remember when I first met the men in this fellowship who preceded me, they came to visit me in Akron City Hospital. And they were all older men than I was, and they all told me the story of what happened to them through drink. And I identified with these fellows. That's a good word. I heard somebody say that in a meeting one time, and I copied it, identified. I think someone with a good education put that in AA. But I did. I felt as one with these men, and I wanted to be one of them. I wanted to belong to this gang. This bunch seemed to be something different. They were like the fellas that I was drinking with in a bottle gang, but they were sober, and they were having a lot of fun. And they all seem to have a sense of humor, and they're all kidding about what they used to do. Well, believe me, at that stage of the game, I wasn't kidding much about what I used to do. It wasn't funny at all, because I was out of a home, I was out of everything, I was on the bum, and this wasn't funny to me. But when these fellas came to me and they told me their stories, I looked at these men, and I wanted to belong. I wanted to belong to something because I didn't belong to anything that was worth anything. I had no friends. I had no, and no one cared whether I was alive or dead. So when I had my chance, they told me that I'd have to spend my life helping other alcoholics. They explained to me, as an alcoholic, I had a talent to help other alcoholics, and I better, by golly, use that talent. Or if I didn't, I would lose it. So I, as a result of that, I became the first and foremost bar stool snatcher in history. And I went around everywhere talking to fellas, men and women, who were drunk and were in various stages of it. I started out with the fellas who the gangs I was drinking with, and I told them all they should quit drinking, they should be like me. But they looked at me and they didn't want to be like me. They all thought I was nuts, so they didn't want this. But I went out and worked with strangers, and I worked with a terrific missionary zeal. And it took me 7 long months before I ever conquered my first baby, and I got him in a hospital. And this was a great triumph for me. I had won my feather. I belonged to the tribe then. And after that, they seemed to come a lot easier. I've looked back on this thing, and I can see why I didn't get anyone. You're supposed to carry the message, and I didn't have much of a message to carry. I had a lot of missionary zeal and enthusiasm, but that's about all I could brag about. So these fellows didn't respond to that type of thing. But eventually, things got going real well as far as sponsoring people. Now, alcoholism, I have learned some things about alcoholism over the years, and I've learned a lot of no-nos about it. I've heard many people say what alcoholism is. They talk about it being a habit, and they talk about it being a matter of taste and all that sort of thing. Well, it can't be a matter of taste for the simple reason that if you can afford palatable liquor, that's mighty fine. But eventually you can't afford it and you'll drink what I drank. I paid 7 cents a pint for my booze and I bought it in a wallpaper store. And if you think I drank that for its palatable qualities, try it sometime. So it's not a matter of taste. If it were a matter of taste, it'd be very simple. We could cultivate a taste for apples or bananas or something. I don't know who wants to eat 40 apples a day, but we could cultivate a taste for something a lot better than what we drank. So it's not a matter of taste at all. That'd be very simple to quit drinking. And people say it's a habit. Well, it's no habit. We start out as a habit, and we had a habit pattern, but we grew beyond that. We progressed beyond the habit stage. And drinking became an obsession to us. It's a way of life. It was an obsession. An obsession is something quite different than a habit. Any habit we have, we could change, or we could modify, or we could overcome by a simple application of a little hurting and a little willpower and a little won't power and substitution in one thing or another. Just like this habit of smoking that most people enjoy so much. If some doctor came along and told you if you didn't quit smoking, you'd be dead in 30 days, by God, you'd quit that right now. You'd quit that. It would hurt, but you'd quit. But we, as far as booze is concerned, we who tried to quit that because it was a habit or a taste, we failed miserably. Finally, when we found out it was an obsession, a way of life, it was found that the only way to whip it successfully and live like a human being's intended to and live a fruitful life is to change our lives completely. And that's exactly what this program calls for. It's when I came to this program, we did not have the 12 steps yet. I was in the old Oxford movement. And they talked about their plan. They called their plan a life-changing plan, a life-changing program. And that's the same thing we have here, is a life-changing program. If you don't believe it, read those 12 steps thoughtfully, and you'll find in those 12 steps there is not one word said in there that to the effect that you shouldn't drink. Did that ever occur to you? It never says you shouldn't drink. It didn't say you should drink either. But there's nothing about not drinking in those 12 steps. Those 12 steps are a prescription for a way of life. Now, I like to talk about the 12 steps. Every once in a while I do this when I'm invited to talk someplace, and I hope that if any of you have been around and I have talked, I hope I don't bore you with a lot of repetition if I go into this program of ours. But I do believe firmly that repetition is very good for us, especially when we're dwelling on the program. I don't care too much for repetition of drunk stories that we've... I don't know how some of these guys do all these drunk stories. They can tell you what they did from the day they started drinking till the day they wound up sober. My God, I can't remember those things. I did a lot of my drinking in blackouts, and from all I can gather, a lot of the things, the most interesting occurrences in my life, I don't even remember. And people have told me about them, and some are on record. But I can't go into one of these blow-by-blow things, but I can tell you a few salient things that have happened to me. But I'd rather tell you about what things have happened to me since I'm sober. We've all been drunk. We don't need any prescription for getting drunk. But we all need prescription for staying sober. Now, in the first place, any chump can get sober. It don't take any genius to get sober. The guy says, yeah, I can quit drinking. I quit 1,000 times. Anybody can quit, sure. The big trick is to stay quit. And we have the prescription for that. And this prescription amounts to a way of life, a change of life, a life-changing program. Now remember, I came to this fellowship before we had these 12 steps. And I probably have a different slant on them than some people have because I was in on the writing of these steps. So I do know something about what each step is supposed to convey to us. And each step has a purpose. I hear people say, well, they've been around here for X number of months, and they say, well, I'm still on the first step. You're what? You're on the first step. What are you drinking today? You know, and then they'll say, well, I'm having a tough time with that fourth step. I'm up to number six. Well, I've had people ask me about these steps, and they say, well, when are you supposed to take them? I say, well, when do you want to start living? If you want to start living, you take them now. There's nothing in here that says you take these at your leisure. I've heard people tell people that they do that. But you can get drunk at your leisure, too. And you can miss an awful lot of things at your leisure. We are getting older every day. We better start finding out how to make use of the few remaining days or years that we may have. And I think the best thing to do is to get into an understanding of this program. And maybe I can throw a little light on some things here that maybe might help someone here tonight. I know that some people don't agree with me. I'm perfectly 100% wrong in every aspect to some people. And people say that Clarence is a very positive individual. He's either positively right or he's positively wrong. And I think they're right about that. And I am quite positive. But about this program, I have some very strong feelings. And it's, I suppose, based on my own experience with it and with the experience of a lot of people I've observed and with also the experience of having been on the scene when the program was originated and written up and started. So I want to go into this tonight a bit. This program of ours, in my estimation, is divided into four phases. The first phase is a phase of admission. The second is submission. The third is restitution. And the fourth is construction. The first phase of our program, admission, is the first step. We have to have a place to begin. We have to have, as I said in the Army, an IP, an initial point. It's we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. That's quite an admission, isn't it? Well, if we admit that, we admit that we're powerless over alcohol, that our life is unmanageable, so what? What do we want to do about it? Some people don't want to do anything about it. It's just as simple as that. But if you do, there's something we have to do. So we start into the second phase. The second through the seventh steps are the second phase. This is a phase of submission. We have admission, now we have submission. Here are the steps in which we, since we're powerless over alcohol and our life is unmanageable, we're going to submit our will and our lives to the care of a higher power, whom I choose to call God. So listen to these next six steps. It says, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. We came to believe that. Didn't say we believed that when we arrived here, but we came to believe it. How did I come to believe this? I came to believe this through the influence of these men who preceded me. They told me that a power helped them. They couldn't help themselves, and it would help me. I wanted help, so I had to believe them. They had the evidence, and they had what I wanted. And so I had to believe. So I came to believe as a result of those men who preceded me, their example. That's how I did it, and I think most of us do. A lot of us come to this fellowship and we have very little ideas about any kind of belief. If we've had them, we've discarded them, or we've watered them down, or we've lost them. So we come here and we come to believe that this power can help us because we can't help ourselves. This is the greatest thing about AA, is this sharing with one another and this power of example that we have. So the third step, here's the one that separates the men from the boys. Here's the step that tells us, that determines, rather, whether we are in AA or not. Remember, you can come to meetings, you can join the clubs, you can get into the fellowship and the fun and all this sort of thing, but you're still not in the AA philosophy if the third step is not accepted. Because that third step demands something of us, and it demands a whole lot. It says, we made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God. How do you like them apples? Made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God. Now, believe me, you, if a person isn't hurting real badly, he's not about to do that. This is where the people start holding reservations, and they start dodging the issue. But if you want to get well, there's a step that separates the wheat from the chaff. You have to take a stand. You have to stand for something. As the old saying goes, if you don't stand for something, you're very apt to fall for most anything. And it's very true. So we made a decision, and that's something in itself for an alcoholic to do. We are the most indecisive people in the world. Take the average rummy, and he makes a date to meet you on the corner of 4th and Main, 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. He'll probably be at 9th and Euclid at 9 o'clock next September sometime. I mean, this is about as reliable as he is in making any kind of arrangements. So here we made a decision, and making a decision is very important to us, because our decisions were all subject to change without notice up to this time. If somebody came along with a jug, all of our good intentions went down the drain. This is about the story of it. So that third step, we made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God. That is very, very important. That brings us into the fellowship. Now, I don't say that you can't come here if you don't take that third step, but I say this, you're not in AA. You might be in BB or ZZ, but you're not in AA. See, you're making up your own program already. And you've made your own programs for years. And so what happened to you? You became powerless over alcohol and your life was unmanageable. So you're going to go on making your own program, are you? Well, good luck, Buster. And fine drinking to you. And wonderful bankruptcy. All the trouble in the world to you. God bless you. These are reservations. All right, the fourth step. Here's a step that I don't think that any rummy worthy of the name has the capacity to take by himself. It says we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Now, can you imagine a rummy approaching AA that has the capacity to make a searching and fearless moral inventory of himself? This is ridiculous. He can't do it. I don't think he can if he's a real 24-carat rummy, because he's been trained over years to find justification for anything he wants to do or anything he's done. So right off the bat, when we step down here to take a moral inventory to find out just what's wrong with us or what little things we do have that is right about us, we're very apt to gild the lily quite a bit. We've always done that. We've had to do that because of our defensive attitude towards society. It's been habituated in us. And I think someone has to be with us to help us with that fourth step. Some good sponsor or some person who is wise in these things of people changing their lives. Someone who is a good counselor can help you. A good sponsor, a good counselor. The fifth step suggests we've done this. Now remember, that says moral inventory. Moral inventory. What moral characteristics do we have? What good ones do we have and what bad ones do we have? take that in our inventory. It says in the next step, it says we admit it to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs, which suggests that someone's been at our elbow helping us with that step. And it doesn't say anything about all the deeds we committed when we were, or misdeeds that we committed when we were drinking. It says something there about the exact nature of the wrongs. We were liars, we were petty thieves, or we were better than that. And all the different things that go on in an alcoholic's character to survive. All this deviousness of ours, we have all this to account for. And I think that when we're taking this moral inventory, if we have a good counselor at our elbow who's been through this same mill, he can be nudging us and he can suggest some things that we probably are trying to overlook. So I think we can make a real thorough, and that's what it's asked for, is a thorough inventory. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory. Boy, imagine an alcoholic doing anything in a fearless manner. He's scared of his own shadow. But there it is. So we have that sponsor to help us with this inventory. We admit it to God, to ourselves, and another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. This gives us a chance to get at them, see? Then it says, the next step, we were entirely ready, get that word, ready for what? To have God remove all these defects of character. How do you like that? We were entirely ready. Not going to get ready or kind of ready or a little bit ready or a whole lot ready. We're entirely ready. An alcoholic is entirely in everything he does. He never does anything by halfway. So we're entirely ready for what? Not that I can remove mine, but he can. Ready to have God remove them. And it says all these defects of character. Well, now, there are a few defects of character. If you were anything like I was or am, you prefer to keep. There's some defects I wasn't too anxious to give up. Some interesting ones. And, well, the program demands the whole bit. For coming into AA, it says very plainly there, we were entirely ready to have God remove all of them. Not part of them. Cuts out reservations again, you see. It just strips us of all of our reservations. We have to come in completely whipped and completely surrendered. See? So, the seventh step says this. This is the last step in the submission. It says we humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. That's something, isn't it? We humbly asked him. Usually when we get in some kind of a jam, we make a deal with somebody. If you'll do this, I'll do that. Dear God, if you'll get me out of this mess, I'll never go out with Sadie Glutz again. I'll be a good boy. I won't do this. I won't steal from the boss. I won't, you know, blah, blah, blah. The old story. We're not making any deals. We're just humbly asking him to remove them. So the good book tells us this, that anything we ask, believing we shall receive. If you believe that, you have faith. If you don't believe it, you better believe it. That's the way it goes. So there is our second phase. We have admission and we've submitted our will and our lives. And we've done this, actually done it. Things have happened to us now. Now we're going into a new life. We're getting prepared to go into a new life. There's a lot of things happened back there in that old life that we need to try to make apologies for and restitution for. So the third phase of our program is restitution. We can't afford to carry that garbage up into our new life. So it says here, we made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing, get that, we became willing to make amends to them all. Now that attitude of willingness to make amends to everyone is very, very, very important. Really. I remember when I was called upon to do this, I balked on this because there were a couple of people in my experience that I just didn't want to face and I didn't want to talk to, I didn't want to have anything to do with. I've often said these several people in my life, that I often wished I had a hotel with 1,000 rooms and I should find them dead in every room. So I'm supposed to make apologies to these people. But I had to do it, and I'm glad I did. Two of my most difficult restitution acts, one was with my brother, and one was with a saloon keeper that I was instrumental in putting into business when I was working for a bank. I made him a loan and got him all his money and helped him out, and he thought I was the greatest guy in the world. And I lived to see the day when he threw me out of his place and told me, never come back in, you SOB, you're no damn good, and blah, 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 a lot of other compliments. And this was my friend who, if he had not been for me, self-pity, he wouldn't had that luscious business. But I had I'd borrowed money from him I'd put things on the tab, I borrowed money for gambling and everything else from him. And I owed him a considerable amount of money when he threw me out. So, I mean, it cost him to do this. He gave up all hope of ever getting anything out of me. Now, that fellow I didn't want to talk to. But eventually I had to do that. And it's a story in itself what happened when I went to see Pete. And he was dying when I went to see him. And I'm glad I got to see him. I'm glad I had a chance to make restitution to my brother. He's also passed away. These things we have to do, and it does something for us, and it helps us start out as clean as possible in a new life. So there we have, it says in the next step, we may direct amends wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. I think the 8th and 9th steps should be taken with the help of your sponsor. People can come into AA new and get all this new enthusiasm and get on that pink cloud, and they can go out and they want to get everything straightened up. You know, typical rummy, you know, it's taking you 20 or 30 years to really foul things up this way. But when they come to AA and they walk through that door, they want everything fixed yesterday already. No, not tomorrow, not next week, not next month. It has to be done right now, see. And so they can get out there with this restitution thing and run out and get themselves in an awful lot of trouble. They can involve other people unwittingly, because I don't think the alcoholic starting out in those days has much wit anyway, and everything's unwittingly to him. So he needs help on that step. But it must be taken if you're going to get the benefit of a new life. This is important. That's a third phase of our program. If you don't think so, I can tell you some examples of what have happened to fellas on this restitution thing. I'll give you some very vivid examples. If I had time, I can tell you about one fella. I ran across this fella. I knew him for some time. He's down in Florida. He didn't come in Florida. He came in elsewhere. And he'd been around the country some. And I got to know this fella pretty well. And he was of questionable character, this boy. I wouldn't ever trust leaving my pants hung up anywhere with any money in them when he's around. And I always kept my hands in my pockets when I talked to him. I mean, this fella had a few little oddities about him. But I liked the guy. He was a good guy. I liked him. I don't say he's a good guy. I liked him. Why do you like people? I don't know. I guess it's just part of us. One day, I run across him down in Sarasota. He says, Clarence, he says, I'm bugged. He says, I need some help very badly. He says, I want to talk to you. I don't know of anyone in the world who might be able to help me. Maybe you can. He says, I have some problems. So I says, well, I'll be through with my business here in a couple hours and we can spend some time together. So we did. And he told me his problems. Well, for starters, this fella had been married 5 times. And he had kids with all the wives except the last one. But he had never bothered to go through any divorce processes, nor had any of his wives died. So he had these wives scattered around hither and yon and kids to match. He had gotten mixed up with some bunch of racketeers in his travels, and he stole a bunch of dough from them. So you know what happens if they ever catch up with you. They make things very uncomfortable for a while, and then everything ends. You don't have any pain anymore. And he was in line for an awful lot of trouble there. He was in trouble with some money that he got mixed up with his money with somebody else's down there, and they were a little bit nasty about this too. Well, those are just starters, but this was a beginning, and it went on from there. Well, this fellow needed some restitution help, believe me. And do you know that fellow has never spent a day in jail, and he's gotten out of all that stuff? And he escaped it all. It took some doing, believe me, it did. But this is what I mean. If this fellow had gone about this in an ordinary way, without the deviousness of rummy advice, he could have really wound up in a great shape. He'd be in that steel chateau the rest of his life, or in a box, one or the other. But this is what is meant by this restitution and working with a sponsor. All right, we've had three phases. We've had admittance, submission, and restitution. Now we're ready to live, right? We've cleaned up the past as best we could. We've turned our will and our life over. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Now we're ready to live. Now listen carefully, because the first time I ever said this, I started a riot. And they haven't gotten over it yet. People have two ears and one mouth. And it suggests to me that they ought to listen twice as much as they talk. I think that's why the Lord made us this way. But people don't, they listen, but they don't hear very well. So I said this, which I'm saying right now. After you have taken these nine steps, after you have done them as I've outlined here, forget them. You never have to bother with them anymore, I hope, except in two instances. As far as yourself is concerned, hope you should never have to do it again. If you should ever resign and resume, obviously, you have to start new. So we have to start all over through the steps again as a new person, which I hope never happens to any of us here. The only other time you have to refer to those nine steps is when you're trying to explain them to someone, as I'm trying to do now, or a new person, or working with a new person. Forget them. You don't have to mess around with them anymore. This makes a very simple program. I'm all for a simple program. This program is easy. It's as easy as falling out of bed, really. People make it tough on themselves. They make it tough because they don't take those nine steps. This is how they make it tough for themselves. They won't accept them. They slide over them. They don't get some tough sponsor to knock it into their heads or knock it into their systems, whether it be their heads or someplace else. Sometimes they need it someplace else. But anyway, once we've taken these steps, once we have taken them, forget them. All we have to concern ourselves with from now on is three steps. The steps of construction. Here's where we construct our lives, a new life. We've gotten rid of the old one because we admitted we couldn't handle things, and we turned our will and life over to God and let Him handle it, and then we made our restitution. Now we're ready to live. So here's how we live. Step 10. This step has absolutely nothing to do with step 4. That step 4 says we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Listen what this 10th step says. It says here, we continue to take personal inventory, not moral inventory, personal inventory, and when we were wrong, we promptly admitted it. Well, there's two things in there. That personal inventory, what does that mean? That personal inventory is our daily check on ourselves. I'll tell you how I take mine, how I do mine. It's very simple. When I get in bed at night, my day is over with. I'm through. I think about my day, I think about whom I've met, whom I've seen, what I've done, and what activities I've been engaged in. Sometimes I owe apologies to somebody. I haven't been as nice as I might have been. I'm a salesman, and I meet some very queer people. Salesmen do. A salesman should have, there should be a season that he's permitted without any prosecution whatever or restraint. There should be a season for salesmen where they can shoot people indiscriminately, customers. And this would be good for us, as any of you people who are in the sales field know. And I suppose the other fields have the same thing, too, to contend with. Well, this tenth step, I lay there at night and I think about what has happened to me today, who I've seen, what I've done, who I've talked to, and what acts I've gone through. And some days I'm not too proud of some of the things that have occurred. Some days I am. Some days I remember, oh, I did such and such a thing, you were a good boy, oh boy, you pat myself on the back. And sometimes I find I owe some apologies to someone. I don't wait. I make immediate restitution and apologies if I've harmed anyone or I've been what I shouldn't be. Now, not that I'm a goody-goody guy. I do this for self-preservation. I've found out in my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous that it is not the big things that throw us. It's the little things. I have seen people in AA, and I have experienced it myself. Tremendous tragedies happened in these people's lives and in my own. And this doesn't throw people. This don't throw them into a drunk. No. Here's how most people get drunk in AA. It's the neglect of little things. They don't make this daily check on themselves. And finally, those little things keep growing and growing and adding up till you can no longer handle them, and it just overpowers us, and our emotional buildup goes kaputs, and away we go. We dive into that jug again. We dive in there to get peace. The only peace we get, we become anesthetized. When a fella or a gal is drunk, he don't hurt. He don't feel anything. He don't feel good either. When he's dead drunk, he's dead drunk. He's dead. The world isn't bothering him. It's only when he has to come back and face the music is when the trouble starts. See? So this tenth step of ours here, I try to keep pace with things so things don't build up on me, because I just can't afford to handle a lot of things. I'm a busy guy, and I like to get around and enjoy life, and I don't want to have these things bugging me. So I get rid of them. It's a good habit to start. The 11th step, listen to this step. I only got 2 hours to go yet, so I better hurry up. The 11th step, here is a terrific step. And listen carefully to this. There's a lot of words in it. But this is a step that leads us into a prayer life. It says in this step here, we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Now, that is a lot of words, isn't it? Let's break them down. Let's simplify this thing. Because as I say, I'm a simple guy and I can't stand too many complications. It says we're seeking something through prayer and meditation. Just what is prayer and what is meditation? Let's get that out of the way. Prayer is talking to God, and meditation is listening to Him. Get that? We have to listen, or we're not going to get the answers and the guidance. So we have to listen. A lot of people say, my prayers aren't answered. Hell, they don't listen for them. They're like this. They have to have them done yesterday, right now. Sometimes the answer is no. Sometimes the answer is put off till you're ready to get the answer, or ready to handle it. Alcoholics have messed up their lives, something fierce, and they want everything right now to be just so-so. And you give it to them just so-so, and they'll blow up. They're not equipped to handle it yet. The good Lord knows when we're ready. We have to help equip ourselves for these things. So we're seeking through talking and listening to Him. What are we seeking? We're seeking to improve our conscious contact with God. Now, just what does that mean? It means that I want to feel that He's right here where I can converse with Him and talk to Him and get answers. He's not way out here beyond the blue yonder here, out of sight and out of reach. He's as close as, the good book says, hands and feet. That's pretty close. That's what we're trying to do in this 11th step. Feel that way about Him so we can talk to Him and get directions. So we're trying to establish our conscious contact with God. Now it tells us what we're praying for. This might shock you. You take people who are talking about praying for sobriety. What are you praying for sobriety for? You have sobriety. Forget it. Thank Him for it. If you want to pray for something, pray for guidance and direction, or pray for other people. Never mind praying for sobriety. That's just ridiculous. You've got sobriety. All that praying's been done for you before. Somebody else has put in the effect of prayers for you. You certainly never did it. So why mess around with it now? Plagiarism. So we're praying, it says here, praying only, get that? Only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. God, what do You want me to do? I'm Your servant. I've turned my will and my life over to You. What do You want me to do? So He gives me the direction to do. I'll bet you a good many of you people have had this experience. So have I, many times. I will suddenly, for reasons wholly unknown to myself, or they may sound illogical or seem illogical, I'll go someplace. I just feel that I must go there. I haven't planned this in my day's plans or my day's work, but I'll go somewhere and see someone or expose myself to something. And I found that, by golly, it's a good thing I did. I was supposed to be there. Now, what do you think sent me there? I didn't plan. I might have given up a chance to make a few bucks to go over there, you too, you know. But I go. And I can stand here for an hour and tell you some very strange, seemingly strange things that have happened to me through that kind of guidance. That's guidance. That's the answer. That's listening. I'm told what to do, and it is not my will at all. And I'll bet you've had these experiences if you've been around here very long, and if you haven't, you're going to have them, and you're going to start wondering what's happening to you sometime when this does happen, because it's going to happen to you. Sure as God made little apples, it'll happen to you. So it says here, we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Well, the good book tells us He'll never put anything on us that He won't give us the power to execute. So there you are. Amazing things have happened in AA. Figure it out yourself. Why do a bunch of beaten down and beaten up and washed out failures, alcoholic, sick, nutty, crazy people turn around and be responsible for the formation and the continuation of this wonderful fellowship? Who did this? Did some real smart people do this? Did a bunch of lawyers get together and organize this deal of ours? Did a bunch of judges do this? Did a lot of doctors do this? Did a lot of psychiatrists? Did a lot of educators form this association of ours? Huh. Bunch of washed out, beat up, beat down, thrown out drunks, alcoholics, who come to an extremity in their lives, and they had no other place to turn but to their God, and He did it. Through us, we are the agents. That's something to think about. It's a terrific thing to think about. Our responsibility as members of this fellowship, we should never take it lightly. I know when I first came to this fellowship, my sponsor was Dr. Bob. And he used to beat this in my head. I didn't have much there to absorb with. But he used to keep dinging these things to me till the repetition of it finally got through. When I came to this fellowship, as I mentioned, we didn't have these 12 steps. We did a lot of Bible reading and research. I don't know much. I couldn't understand much of this stuff, but I read it. He told me to. And he gave me other different things of spiritual nature to read and to try to digest. And having been away from such things for so long, it was not making too much sense to me. But it was keeping me out of doing a lot of other things at the time. But eventually some of these things came through to me. And I'll tell you about a few of these things in a few moments if I remember it. And it's remarkable, really, how these things come to us. But there you are. It doesn't say we're praying for sobriety or we're praying for a new job or a new yacht or a new house or a new wife or a new anything. It says we're praying only for knowledge of His will for us. The power to carry that out. That's our introduction to a prayer life, which we also sorely need. Now, the 12th step, here's the one that they really malign. You hear people talk about 12-stepping. Just what does this 12-step consist of? It says, having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps. See? It assumes we went through these steps, as I've been trying to point out here. And as a result of that, we had a spiritual experience. Now, just what does that mean? Some people call it a spiritual awakening, a spiritual experience, a spiritual change. It is a change. It's a change in here, not in here. We don't have anything up here to change. It's here. This is where it changes. We go on the give instead of the take. We start sharing, and we get unselfish. This is what's important. We lose that obsession. We lose that awful drive that we have to have to satisfy this obsession to drink. We think of other people. We go out and knock ourselves out. It doesn't make any difference. It's rain, snow, wind, blow, whatever. We go out on these 12-step calls to talk to some donkey we never heard of before. And we'll stay there all day, we'll stay there all night, and go back the next day. We'll buy him a drink if he needs it. We'll take care of him. We do all these things. Why do we do this? This is not our pattern. All we ever did when we were drinking, we were trying to figure a way to satisfy this obsession of ours. Now we're given freely of our time and our talents and our efforts and our substance. That's quite a change. This indicates something's happened to us. We've had a spiritual change. It's not a mental change. We didn't just decide to do that. We want to do that. It makes us feel some way. We feel we want to do it. So having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, this is exactly what we start out to do, is to get a changed life, and it's happened to us. It's a very simple program, very simple. If this is too complicated to live on those last three steps, here's something that you can say to yourself. But all your life you're going to have problems. You're going to have decisions to make. And we're going to make decisions. And so we're going to make mistakes. That's why they put rubbers on lead pencils. We're not right all the time. But here's one thing we can ask ourselves when it comes up to a point of decision. When all else fails, and you're trying to make a decision from one thing to the other, you ask yourself, well, how would Christ do this? You get the answer. That's the quickest prayer you can make. Try it sometime. So there's our program. Now, as it says in that fifth chapter, many of us exclaim, ooh, what an order. I can't go through with it. Oh, yes, you can. You can if you want not to drink. You can if you hurt badly enough. You sure can. But if you don't hurt badly enough, you won't. It's just as simple as that. Now, we don't all have to wind up on Skid Row, as I did. Everyone has his own Skid Row. I've met a lot of alcoholics who drank themselves down to their second last yacht, and they're just as bad off as I was. really, that's their skid row. Yeah, there's a lot of people in AA that are very, very well off. Money was no object, financial things, but something in that spirit is the object. The way they feel is the object. And when he feels badly enough, and he feels that awful feeling of defeat and aloneness, then he's ready here, see? This is a field here that we have to lose before we can win. We must surrender and give up completely and start from behind scratch. And that's what makes this thing tick. That's a hard thing to explain to earth people. It's a hard thing to explain to these experts in alcoholism. I have met a good many of them. I've given up even trying to talk to them anymore. They just confound me because they know for stay. You can go so far with them and then everybody's lost. In my experience, I have talked to all types of groups of people. I mean earth people, civilians. I've talked to groups of ministers, groups of lawyers, groups of judges, doctors, what have you. Social workers by the ton. I've talked to these experts in these alcoholic rehabilitation plans, and boy, I've come to one great big conclusion. Just stay away from them. Nothing you can do about it. The only thing we can ever do is to talk to your doctor and tell him that you're available to help him with any of these slobs that are waking him up at 3 o'clock in the morning and never paying him. He'll give you some good prospects. You can talk to your minister and tell him that you'd be glad to help these alcoholics who come to him, or their wives or husbands come to him in distress, and you'll be glad to help. But don't try to convert those people. Don't try to convert the doctor or the minister or the lawyer or the judge or the social worker, and don't try to explain what we're doing. It's no use. You're just spinning your wheels. They'll never, never get past a certain point there. It always comes up in the end, why this, why that? Well, how the heck do we know why this? We know what works, and we know how this guy feels we're dealing with, and he's going to feel along with us, and he's going to go along and be all right. So that is our program. And like it or not, that's it. If you want to be an AA, that's the story. Now, we talked about this thing of when I first came to this fellowship, I didn't have much here. I don't have much here yet, but at least I'm not in trouble with everybody, and I'm able to hold a job down occasionally, and I'm able to keep out of jail, and I don't have to, I'm not running from anyone. I don't have to worry about getting, the bill collectors aren't bothering me. I had to run away and hide where they didn't know I was at one time. Nobody's turning my lights off. Nobody's turning my gas off. No one's, I mean, everything is okay. I get along with all these earth people. I have to put up with them. And I get along with them. And all these utility companies and everybody. So everything's going all right. But I got to remember always what my position in life is and who I am. I am Clarence Snyder, an alcoholic. Now, what I learned when I first came in, I didn't have much, as I say. And Doc used to, and I'd ask my sponsor questions. And I asked a lot of questions because I was completely bereft of everything. I mean this, I was quite inquisitive. So I'd ask him a question, and he'd say, well, what does it say in the good book? You know, I says to him one time, for instance, what's all this first things first that people are blatting about? What are they talking about, first things first? This is very complicated to me in my condition at the time. He says, what does it say in the good book? I says, I don't know, what does it say? He says, oh, read it. I says, where do you start? He says, well, I'll tell you what this means. He says, you'll find it in the New Testament. He says, read it. He says, first things first, he says, seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. So the first thing, the first concern in my life is seek the kingdom of God and His righteousness. This didn't make too much sense to me, but he knocks me back on my heels as usual. So this has to permeate through here, and eventually it makes a little sense. So I got to reading these stories in the good book, and there's some tremendous stories in the Bible. If you've never experienced this, try it sometime. There's some wonderful rummy stories in the Bible. I don't know if I ever told any of you folks these rummy stories that are my favorites, but I'll tell you one thing, this story of the Good Samaritan, there is a rummy story, par excellence. Everybody in that story was a rummy. Here, just get the picture of this guy. He's lying out there in the middle of the road, stripped. He don't have a stitch of clothes on him. He's all beat up. He's just knocked half senseless. And there he is, laying out there. And what do you think he is? He's a rummy. He's been rolled. It's exactly what's happened. So along comes a priest. He sees this duck laying out there. He knows he's a rummy, and he's been rolled and thrown out somewhere. See, they even took his clothes. He's got nothing. So he passes by on the other side of the street, see? Then a Levite comes along, and he sees him. He's, that dirty drunken so-and-so. He deserves it. He's got it coming to him. Let him have it. The hell with him. So he crosses over and leaves him. He's not going to get involved with this bird. Why should he? You find people today that won't get involved with anybody either, you know. So they skip him nuts to that guy. They know. They've seen these drunks roll before. So along comes this Samaritan. And the Samaritans in those days were not the favorite people. They weren't the social elite. But this fella is a traveling salesman. He really was. This guy had come along, the Samaritans are a traveling salesman. I can prove this to you. And he gets down off of his form of transportation, which was probably a mule. It wouldn't be a Chevrolet. And he gets off of this thing, and he got down there, and he administered to this guy. He even put some wine on him, you know. He gave him a slug. Read that story. He knew what he was doing. So he takes this guy, and he cleans him up a little bit and puts him on his form of transportation, probably draped him over this mule, and away he goes. And what did he do with him? He takes him to an inn. And here's how I know they're both rummies, see? So he takes him to this innkeeper. He says, hey, take care of this guy. He says, and here's some money. See, he gave the money to the innkeeper. He didn't give it to the rummy. Hey, you know. He says, you take care of this guy, and if there's any more, I'll pay you next time I come by, which proves he's a salesman making that territory. So next time he comes through, we're going to pay him. He has an account with the guy. He had a credit card. Now, there's a rummy story, if there ever was one. There's a first AA call on record. You want to read an older rummy story than that? Read the story in the first chapter, the first book of the Bible in Genesis. Read the story of Noah and on the ark. Boy, did he ever tie one on that ark. Yeah, boy. And who would ever do a stunt that Noah did unless he was a rummy? Who would ever think of getting two this and two? This is ridiculous. Nobody would a rummy ever get that crazy. He did it. And then he got drunk, and he really made an ass out of himself on that ark. He sure did. Read the story. That's our first reference in the Bible to people getting slopped. There are plenty of other ones. My other favorite story, one of my very favorite stories in the good book, Rummy Story, is the story of the prodigal son. Boy, this is a dandy. Here's these two kids, these two boys. In Jewish culture, of course, the boys were to inherit from the old man when the old man died. Well, this old man was well off, and he had a big farm going there and big operation going, and this one older son, he was a good, dutiful boy, and he went out and did everything the old man wanted him to do. He worked like a Trojan out there on that farm. But this other kid, the younger one, he doesn't want to wait till the old man dies. Get this? He wants his right now. Did we say something about right now before? He wants his now. He don't want to wait till the old man dies to get his share of the loot. So he bugs the old man and bugs him. He wants his part of the estate now. He finally got on the old man's nerves so badly, the old man says, okay, here, take your share of it and be gone with it. Quit bugging me. So he gives the kid this money, and away he goes. And what does it say in the good book? Listen to this. He says he went into a far country, and he squandered his substance in riotous living. Did you ever hear of anything like that? He squandered his substance in riotous living, the dirty stinker. And a famine set in, and he's in his far country, and he's broke. He's tapped out. The whole bundle's gone. He blew the works. It's gone, just like any good rummy would do with a bunch of money. He never had any before. So it's gone. And he's really up against it. Remember, this kid's a Jew. So what does he do? He has to exist, and he's miles and miles from home in a far country. So he gets a job. You know what kind of a job he got for this little Jew boy? He gets a job on a hog farm, if you please. A hog farm. And it says that he's eating of the husks of the hogs. He's eating what the hogs left over. Now, this is really coming down some, isn't it? This kid had been a millionaire's son. He's eating what the hogs wouldn't eat. The husks of the hogs. Now, this is what's important. It says, and he says, and he came to himself. He came to himself. You know? That's exactly what you and I had to do. We came to ourselves. He says, my father has much, and I am here eating of the husks of the hogs. I'm starving in this country. This famine is here. He says, here's what's important. He said this, and this is what we have to say. He says, I will arise and go to my father. See? I will tell him I am not worthy. He says, I will arise and go to my father. And that's what he did, and that's what you and I had to do when we came to AA, and we had to tell him we are not worthy. He don't judge us this way. He accepts us. So this kid went off, and away he went. He went back home. And what happened when he got there? Well, this brother is out there still working on that farm, boy, doing the dutiful. He was a civilian brother. And he's working like a good civilian would. See, doing just exactly what the old man wants him to do. No sweat, no trouble with the old man. So this kid comes back, and the old man, what says in the story, he says, the father saw him coming afar off, see? And what did he do? The old man, did he chew him out? No. It says that the old man ran to his boy to meet him. He says, and he fell on his neck and he kissed him. He says, my son who is dead is alive. He says, put shoes on his feet and a ring on his finger and a cloak on him. Let's have a party. My son who is dead is alive. So he takes the kid up to the house, and they have a big blast up there. They're really having a party. They're really going up there, see? So this other kid out there working out in the fields, he hears all this racket going on, and he's still working away like a good civilian. So finally one of the servants comes out. He says, hey, bud, what's going on up there in the house? He says, didn't you know? He says, no, what? He says, your brother came home. Ooh, he says, that's no good. So he says, what goes on? Well, your father's having a party for him. Ooh, the kid gets mad. He drops everything, goes back to the house, and there, the blast is going on. He says, Pop, he says, what goes here? He says, your brother, my son, who is dead, is alive. Let us make merry. He says, Pop, that guy is no good. He never did anything you asked him to do or told him to do. I've been a good son. I've done blah, 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 blah. This is the way the civilian reacted. Well, the old man had to straighten him out. I think that's a great rummy story. That's exactly what happens to all of us. But he ran to him, and he fell on his neck and kissed him. He's so happy. It's a story of the lost sheep. There's another one, you know. It's the same thing. These are emphasized. These stories emphasize. This is the first bit of good out of the Bible I ever could ever registered with me, these stories that they had. I read these stories, and I was always a hero in the play, you know. I put myself in there, and it became meaningful to me. This is my first glimpse of any kind of understanding of those things. And this is how it started with me. I hope that it might make some sense with you or somebody. How long have I been going here, and what time is this? I can't even read this thing. But I'll tell you one thing. I just want to close with a couple remarks. I hear a lot of things said in AA, a lot of things that have crept in. And one thing that gets me is when somebody says, there are no musts in AA. If you believe that, you go read that book and take a pencil and mark, and you'll find 37 spots in the good book that it says must. And here are some musts that I want to remind people of that have a penchant for saying there are no musts, you can do this any way you want. First of all, you must be an alcoholic. If you're not an alcoholic, you don't belong in here, you know, as far as the membership is concerned. You belong as a family of the alcoholic, like an Al-Anon-Alateen or something, but I mean the alcoholic, the drinker, must be an alcoholic. This is not a society for just heavy drinkers. This is a society for alcoholics who want to do something about it. And I've come to the conclusion that that's what they want. Then you must prepare for recovery. You must be prepared for this. And we prepare over a number of years. Believe me, we come well qualified here. And I want to say this. This is the most exclusive fellowship you can ever join. I see people who join these fancy golf clubs and yacht clubs, and they pay $1,000 tuition and so much a month, and they think this is great. See, they think they belong to the most exclusive thing in the world. Probably cost them $5,000 over their lifetime to belong to the bloomin' thing. What do you think it costs you to join this? Nobody ever gets into AA with under $50,000. Figure it out. The money you blew, the opportunities you blew, the businesses you lost, the things that happened, the heartaches and everything, count it up sometimes. Find out what it costs you to prepare yourself for this lodge of ours here. You better believe it. It's the most exclusive thing you can get into. And you should be very thankful that you've been invited. Right. Then we must want to recover. This is important. I've met a lot of rummies who don't want to recover. They want to live that way. I lived on the skids. Some of you people have. You've met people that don't want to face life and face that fight, that battle for living anymore. You just don't want to put up with that. They've given up. They don't have anything left in here yet to fight that with. I knew a fella, knew him a long time. He was quite a fella. He was an educated man. He was an engineer. And he hit the skids. And right after I came out of the service, I had a job for a while as a personnel man in a steel company. And I ran into my old pal one day, and he happened to be sober this day. Every time I'd ever meet this fella, I was always good for a half a dollar. He was the only guy I ever gave a half a dollar to in my life, a rummy. I used to give him a dime. 10 cents was my limit. I had a 10-cent limit. I can go for a quarter now, but in those days it was a 10 cents. But I used to give this guy a half a buck. I loved this guy. Well, anyway, I gave him a job in a steel company, and he didn't last. He didn't last. He worked a few weeks and had a good job, too. And he was a good man. He knew his business. And he wouldn't do it. So I went and talked to him. And he told me, frankly, he taught me a lot of things about why people don't want to fight this thing anymore. And he was one of them. And he ended his days that way on Skid Row. He had all the potential in the world this man had to hold a good position, have a nice home. He had a nice family that he walked away from. And he could have had anything he wanted in creature comforts. Didn't have the guts to do it anymore. And there are people like that. Remember that. So we must want to recover. Then we must admit that we are powerless. We must admit we are powerless over alcohol. Then we must make restitution. Then we must make this daily check that I talked about in the 10th step. Then we must witness or affirm. We must tell people about this and carry this message to other people. We must be thankful. We must be unselfish. We must have active appreciation of this fellowship of ours. And we must have a changed life, and we must constantly try to improve ourselves in three areas of our living: mentally, morally, and spiritually. These are the musts. There's a lot more of them, but these are some. So when some turkey gets up here and tells you there are no musts in AA, you might remind him of these things. Because there are musts. I don't care what you fellowship you join. You join the PTA or the Masons or the Knights of Columbus or the Elks or the Moose. There's things that are required of you in just simple organizations like that. What do you think's required of you to come in and have your whole life changed, where it's in your hands perhaps rests the destiny of some other human being? It's very important to think about this. So there are musts. This is not a program to take lightly. This is forever. This is it. We go the whole way. It's whole hog or nothing in this fellowship. This is the way we are made. This is how in the world could anyone consider people who are extremists like us, that lived to extremes, drank to extremes, did everything in extreme, what would ever suggest to any person that we can recover in any other manner but the extreme? We can never get too much AA. We can never get too much of this fellowship. We can never get too much smartness about this thing. We must learn and develop ourselves in this and get efficient in this fellowship. And while we're getting efficient, we may not fix everybody we talk to, but our percentage is going to be a lot better. And at the best, it's going to help us as individuals. This is what we're supposed to do. This is part of the game. This is the name of the game. Carry the message. That's your 12th step. But we must be prepared to carry it. So going through these steps gives us that privilege and that consideration. It's a great privilege to belong to this fellowship, and I'm always happy to be invited to come out and meet a lot of my old friends and make a lot of new ones, such as I'm doing tonight. I again want to thank you for being so good to me since I've been here. I'm going to hang around yet tomorrow and see what goes on around here, see if they can turn this rain off. Every place I go, it rains. This guy here from California says, "Remember when I saw you out in Chico, California, how it rained?" Need another guy back here and says, "Remember when you were over there in Tennessee, how it rained?" See some people from North Carolina is up there. "Remember how it rained?" Why does it rain? I was in California last week, and it never rains out there now, but it's pouring when I got out there. Why is this? I'm going to get a link up with some Indian tribe who do all these dances and see if they can't let me in. I can get paid for this. Or I'm going to get mixed up with the Baptists and the Methodists who are always praying for rain and not getting it. Maybe I can do them some good. But it's for sure. But the weather means nothing. I lived out in that rain under bridges, boy. And I know I'll take it as it is now. Thanks very much for being so good to me.